Accession number 4616, reel number 2.
Flight Lieutenant Lucas, Reel 2. Can you tell me about the exams which you took on leaving Flower Down?
They're in two main parts, one purely educational and the other, oh, I should say probably three parts. Purely educational, purely technical, and the third part would be practical. The educational was very, very high. The mathematics, for instance, which they expected us probably to use at some future date. We went to calculus, and what I can see about it, never heard of it before, and nobody seems to have heard of it since. But we covered calculus, higher mathematics. We even touched general knowledge, what happened in the 14th century, and what part did England take in this, and so on and so forth. English, we had to be able to do all verbs, nouns, and all that sort of thing. No, it was very high, the educational side was. We probably spent a quarter of our training on education, and the other three quarters was on theoretical knowledge of equipment and the practical side of equipment. So the three parts that we had to qualify in when we came were, as I said, the educational, technical, and theory technical, and the practical side. One of the practical sides was making a certain sized tube, also making a square with a file, filing it down to make an exact square, and these were all tested and made and tested on with a micrometer, so they had to be exact. They were very, very precise in their training and their examinations. No, I think both technical and educational, they were very, very high.
Did any of the boys fail?
Yes, there were certain ones on failed. Not a great many, but I think of our 66, I think there was probably about 16 would fail. They were probably put back, if I remember, they were put back to the next entry so as to give them a second chance. What happened after that, I don't know. But about 50 of us, I think, qualified in the first case after 2 years, about 2 years at Flower Down. So it was fairly strict.
What happened to you after Flower Down?
After Flower Down, I was supposed to do number 17 Fighter Squadron, and this meant mainly a maintenance of the equipment, as I spoke before, where they first started telephony in the air for fighters, with only a range of 2 or 3 miles, and maintenance of ground station equipment as well. I volunteered and got a little bit of flying as a passenger while I was there, saw one or two strange things happen. We used to fly on that as in the good old Avro 504K, which is a relic of before the First World War, I believe. But, of course, all the squadron was fitted with Sopwith Snipes, which were World War I fighters. There was another squadron on the station, and they were fitted with a modern aircraft. They were fitted with Gloucester Grebes, but they were brought in, I think, after the First World War.
What were these strange things that you were referring to?
Well, such things as accidents. I remember once when I was flying, we were flying as a target in this old fight, Evro, and fighters were attacking us. And one aircraft flew straight at us and turned away, and as he turned away, one wing just fell off. So that was the end of him.
He was killed, was
it? Oh, yes. There were no such things as parachutes in those days. No parachutes. He just went down like a brick, and that was the end. It was a strange sort of thing you saw.
What was the cause of that?
I don't know, in those days they didn't talk about metal fatigue or anything, but it's possible that was the sort of cause of it. Metal fatigue was never mentioned in those days. I can always remember him. And I don't know. It was, as I say, it was a new thing, this radio, and flying and radio were new things, and we thought we were coming into a new, brand new world, which we were doing, really. It was all so new. And about this time, as you probably would find out, about this time, they started with the good old 2LO, where they used to broadcast, and everybody had a crystal set at home.
What was the 2LO?
That was the London station. It was the only wireless station to broadcast, you see, where you got BBC and all that sort of thing now. All we had was a long-wave transmitter, 2LO. His call sign was 2LO. Hello, this is 2LO calling you. We now have a piece of music or something like that, you see. And you received it on a crystal set. And I remember about 1923, we were all taught, we all encouraged to make our own crystal sets and take them home, you see. And I took mine home, and my mother was most taken up with having a wireless set in the house, a crystal set, and could hear people talking over the air. Oh, yes, it was certainly an interesting period, there was no doubt about it.
You mentioned the Avro 504K.
Mm-hmm.
What was that like to fly in?
Well, if the wind blew very strong against you, you'd go backwards. That was quite common. You could go backwards in them if the wind was very strong.
Because they were so slow?
Yes, so they had an average speed of, I should think, of about 40 miles an hour. When you were flat out, about 40 miles an hour, as far as I remember. And a good, steady old biplane it was. A good, steady old aeroplane, and fairly safe. As I say, they had no speed. 40 miles an hour was a good speed for them.
Were they popular with the crews?
They were just taken as more or less as a trainer or get you from here to there sort of thing, and that was about all.
Did they have any faults?
Well, from my point of view, no, I didn't know of any at all. But from a rigger's point of view, I should think they had certain faults. As I say, the wing falling off and things like that. It wasn't unknown for wings to fall off. They did happen occasionally. And also there was no parachute, so you had to be very lucky to get away with that.
When did parachutes come in?
Well, I remember parachutes first starting when I was about 1925, I think it was, when I was abroad. 1926, when I was abroad, they gave us a demonstration with a dummy. And it came down and hit the ground so blessed hard, we all said, well, we're not going to use those sort of things, you see. But, of course, we were made to use them in the end, and then they saved one or two lives, so we more or less agreed that they could be useful, you see. But it was about 1926, I should think, before they were issued and you had to wear them. About 1926.
Were they comfortable to wear?
No, I don't think so. You were strapped up, you know, very much strapped up with them. And if you had the parachute with you, you hooked it on the front of you, so it got in your way. We used to take it off and throw it down the tail somewhere when you were flying, you see, and if you ever wanted it, you'd have to crawl down the tail and find it and bring it back and put it on, sort of thing, because it was just in the way, normally.
Was that against the rules?
Yes, you're supposed to wear them all the time, but people didn't, pilots didn't either.
You said that 17 Squadron was equipped with Sopwith Snipes.
Yep.
How many were there to the squadron?
Probably 10 or 12, I should think. I think it would be three flights of three aircraft, you see, and there'd be the spares. Probably one to each flight spare. But there'd be three aircraft in the formation for a flight, you see, a formation of three. You all used to fly in threes.
What was a snipe like?
Well, they did have a dual snipe there, and I did one or two trips in those. Well, once again, they were very fast, you see. They could do about 70 or 80 miles an hour, you see. They were very fast, the aeroplane. They were very fast, the aeroplane, to us. Fairly comfortable. But from a pilot's point of view, I don't know, of course. I didn't do any actual flying at all until later on when I I never qualified as a pilot, of course, but I used to do quite a bit of it when I was abroad. The pilots would let you take over and he'd have a sleep while you were flying somewhere and you just flew by the compass and that was it.
Was that against the rules as well?
Oh, officially I suppose it was, but it was a recognised thing. Everybody used to do a little bit of this, that and the other.
Did the snipe have any faults that were criticised?
Can't remember any. I think they were a product of the First World War and we had very few accidents with them, with the actual snipe. The accidents we did have was only when they tried to fly through a house or something like that, where the pilot error misjudged things. But as far as technical faults or that sort of thing, I don't think there were a lot of them. Very few accidents there was in those days. As I say, the speed was probably a lot to do with it. And when you've got an aircraft doing 70 mile an hour, it's a bit different to an aircraft doing 700 mile an hour. There must be more accidents these days because of that. The human body can't keep up with it, or the human mind can't keep up with these high speeds so much.
What was the other squadron on the base?
They were on Gloucester Greaves, they were. They were a bit faster. They could do up to 100 mile an hour, I believe. But I had nothing at all to do with those.
Can you remember the number of the squadron which shared Hawkins Bay?
Yes, 25 that was. 25 squadron. Remember those?
How did the two squadrons get on with each other?
Oh, I don't think... We got on very well with each other when the occasion arose, but we never mixed a great deal. We seemed to be entirely separate from them, I don't remember. That's that bad. We seemed to be entirely separate from them. We got on well with them when we met, and in the normal way, you know, socially, so on and so forth. But from a working point of view, I don't think we met hardly at all. They had the same sort of wireless equipment as we had, but... We didn't have anything to do with them at all.
Wasn't there any rivalry between the two?
Not noticeable, because they were a much better aeroplane than they, a much faster aeroplane than they could do 30 or 40 mile an hour faster than we, because they had one over us on that.
So, did 17 Squadron envy 25 Squadron their Greaves?
Possibly, yes. But it never came to any actual facts. We thought it must be nice to be able to go that little bit faster. But no, there was no bitterness in those days between the squadrons. I don't know if there is these days, but no, between squadrons and between groups of trades and all that, there never seemed to be any bitterness at all. We got on very well together, I think.
How did the pilots behave responsibly, or were they up to all kinds of tricks?
Well, they had the invariable man that always tried to fly under the railway bridge, and his pal was riding up the road on a pushback. He'd fly down and try and settle on top of him, sort of thing, or almost settle on top of him. I used to pull those sort of jokes, and just flying under bridges. There was quite a craze of it at one time. One or two people were killed trying to do it, but I remember flying under a railway bridge once, but I didn't know anything about it until we'd done it. It was very interesting. I say flying was a new thing in those days. After the First World War, there were just the very, very few people that had ever done any flying, and we were the first ones that really started to make a habit of it.
Can you describe your own particular duties at Hawking?
Yes, it was maintaining the equipment, the wireless equipment, this radio telephony equipment on the aircraft and also the transmitter on the ground. That's all we did because I was in the squadron, you see. And we just maintained the equipment so that it was always serviceable on the aircraft and we could always speak to them from the ground, although it had such a limited range. As I said before, if you can't hear me, waggle your wings, sort of thing. That's how it was.
So, when you arrived at Hawking and said that you'd had no training on RT, what was their reaction?
You have the theoretical and technical knowledge. We were taught the theory of and the technical side of all radio as it was known in those days, so therefore we had to adapt ourselves to it, and we did. We did it, made a fairly good job of it, because, as I say, we had the technical, theoretical and practical training on all sorts of wireless training. There was such a thing as we heard at Flower Down speaking over it, and then when 2LO, the civilian station, came on the earth, of course we really did get interested and we knew a bit more about it. And when we got Hawkins, we just had to adapt ourselves with the knowledge we had.
Were you trained then by the people who were already there?
Well, they probably just showed us the equipment. There was a little bit of jealousy, probably, that you spoke about earlier, a little bit of jealousy. When we went, we were ex-apprentices, so people that were there already before that were not apprentices would say, you're an apprentice, you know it all, there you are, there's it, get on with it. There was a bit of that attitude there was. But generally speaking, we got on very, very well, but there was that bit of attitude about it. We'd had all the training, so we should know all about it. Oh, yes.
What was life like on a base like Hawking as compared with Flower Down and Halton?
Well, it was a much better life. You got out more, you had more time off, and the work seemed to be more interesting in the fact that you were actually doing the job that you'd been trained for at Flower Down. You were actually doing the job, so it was a much better life. After, when I left Hawking, I went abroad, you see, so once again, a totally different life, and it was really good. It was a good life, I think. I had 10 years, and in that occasion, I had 10 years, and I thought it was a life worth living. I was really interested in it.
Was discipline a lot less strict at Hawkinge?
No, it was a lot less than it was at Flower Down or Holden. It was a lot less than it was there. But there was still a certain amount of discipline. You still had the old business of standing to attention to a corporal and all that sort of thing. You had to live up to the initial stages of discipline. Yes, it was still quite a bit of discipline there was.
What about the uniform that you had in the RAF in those days?
Pantaloons and putties. We used to wear pantaloons and putties then.
Did you like that?
No, I don't think anybody likes wearing pantaloons and putties. You had to wind the putties around your legs, and you always got them too tight or too loose, and they used to slip down or something like that. But when I went after there and I went abroad, of course, life was quite a lot different abroad.
We'll come on to your period in the Middle East in a minute, but can you tell me where you went to after Hawkinge?
Well, I think I had a very little short period, only a couple of months, while I was waiting to go abroad at Uxbridge on the main wireless station. There, I just did wireless operating on the main station. Everything was done. Once again, if I remember, we still had spark transmitters at Uxbridge, still had spark transmitters. I never touched them at all. I did nothing but operating there, just wireless operating there on the main station, which was sending and receiving in Morse, you know, dots and dashes. But I was only there for a couple of months, and then I was posted, as I say, to the Middle East in 25.
What was your reaction when you heard that you were going to the Middle East?
Very keen. Nice to go abroad and see the world, sort of thing. Yes. Oh, yes, it was quite interesting.
Was there any particular area that you wanted to go to?
No. Middle East was, you know, as it turned out to be, it was a life worth living out there. You saw so many things. You did so many things. No, it was a good life, and I was quite prepared to go, and I wanted to go. That's what I want to say then, that way.
Did you have to make any special preparations for going out?
No, I think not. No. Just had to report to somewhere or other and went down to Southampton and got on the troop ship.
What was the troop ship journey like?
Well, that was a bit rigid, a bit sticky, but they were very, very strict on the troop ship. Of course, I suppose they had to be, really.
In what way?
Well, used to have life belt drill probably six times a day sort of thing. They were always very keen on that, which was quite right, they should do. And used to have parades. We used to stand to attention for a long time, or stand at ease for a long time. But otherwise, there was quite a bit of just sitting about on the deck. It wasn't bad. It was about a 10-day trip to Port Sloane, and enjoyable. Used to sit on the deck and play housey most of the time.
What were your what was your accommodation like?
We slept in hammocks, which was very, very uncomfortable and entirely new to us. We slept in hammocks on that trip. Not very comfortable. I don't know if you've ever slept in a hammock, but it's not very nice.
What were your first impressions of Egypt?
Oh, very romantic. In fact, I did nearly 6 years in that part of the world, and I thought the whole time it was very adventurous and romantic, shall I say. Very adventurous. When I first got there, I went down to headquarters in Cairo, and I had about 9 months there, and then I asked to get moved out to the practical side of flying a theatre squadron. But I had about 9 months in Cairo on main station work once again. I did mostly operating there. But I got around in Cairo itself, the most interesting city, Cairo. I enjoyed that very much. And then I was posted up to 14 squadron, this was this time, when I went up to Transjordan. And this was the real job. This is the job I liked, you see. And I had a good 5 years there of mainly flying, quite a bit of maintenance work and quite a bit of main station operating. But I always was very keen on the flying side of it. I liked the flying side of it. When you could take off in those days and you could work with Baghdad and Cairo at the same time sort of thing, it seemed wonderful, very romantic. And we used to go out a lot on the desert, you know, landing beside tribes, and our job was more police work in those days. A lot of the tribes would be robbing other tribes, so we had to go out and support the armoured cars. And used to mix quite a lot with the Arabs, the real Arabs. Very, very good they were. I liked the Arab. I think he's a fine chap.
Why did you like him?
His manner, the way he went about his own life, seemed to be interesting somehow. They always made us welcome too. You could always bet when you landed beside him, you'd have a cup of tea. They always had tea there. And I went out on one or two lonely spots, more or less by myself, with just a native guard up on the Syrian border. I was out there for probably a month, 6 weeks, and just run a wireless station, you see, and I had a native guard to look after me. Those are the sort of things we know when you mix people. That was an old Crusaders town, that was where I went to, and that place, I'm thinking, you're there.
What was it called?
It was called Mother of Camels, Umm al Jumal. Always remember that, Umm al Jumal, Mother of Camels. And the Crusaders have made quite a big town of it. And there's still skeletons there in their graveyards there. Still skeletons, our group captain used to come out and look at it quite a bit, and he always said they were the skeletons of the Crusaders.
Well, the skeletons were on the surface, weren't they?
They were down in vaults. And you could go into the vaults because the vaults were wide open, so then you could go down into them. I used to wander around there quite a bit. I enjoyed that. I was out there about 6 weeks by myself, and then the relief came out.
So you were the only RAF man there?
That's right, yes. RAF and about six native guards, with a native sergeant in charge of the native guard, you see.
Were the native guards part of the RAF?
No, they probably belonged to the Arab Legion. And very strangely, on the TV the other night, some programme or other, they brought in the commanding officer of the Arab Legion. Can't think of his name for the moment. But
a British chap?
Yes, he was a commanding officer. Glubb, that's right. Yes, I knew old Glubb. He was a very nice chap. He was very decent to everybody, because I was only an Irk at those times. And he was very good, and it was his people that, you know, he used to supply the guards for us for those sort of things. How come that you know Glubb's name like that?
We interviewed him.
Oh, down in Sussex somewhere, isn't it?
Hmm. So weren't you lonely there, being the only RAF chap?
No. Life seemed interesting. I used to wander around, as I say, was in this old Roman city and used to go wandering around in the desert. When I arrived there, I went out by train to the nearest station, which was about 15 miles from the place I was actually going to, and I was met by the native guard there, and I had the option of riding the 15 miles on a camel or on a horse, you see. I think I walked 14 and a half miles. I don't know if you ever tried riding an Arab horse or riding a camel, but oh, it was a terrible journey. But it's interesting, as I say, once again, it's very, very interesting.
What were you actually doing at this outpost at Mother of Camels?
If we saw anything from the over the border, see the Syrian border, the French were running Syria at that time. If we saw anything out of the usual, we used to report it. I used to report it, you see. It was left to me to report what I thought worth it. I don't know if I reported several. When the Arab, when the Foreign Legion turned up there, just the other side of the border, because we were right on the border, the Foreign Legion turned up there. They were very, we, our people were very interested in that. But there was no Englishman among the Foreign Legion at all. They made sure that no Englishmen were on the Foreign Legion against a land controlled by the English at all. So there was no possibility of anybody trying to escape from the Arab, from the Foreign Legion.
So you would observe visually?
That's right, just happening. Visually, and then report what I thought was worth reporting.
So you weren't trying to intercept French wireless messages?
No. If you saw a tribe passing through, or a lot of cattle on the move, or anything like that, you'd report it, you see. There was a lot of cattle stolen by one tribe or another. They used to steal each other's cattle. And if they got caught, they were hung. Used to hang them for stealing cattle in those days. Yeah.
Were the French regarded as a threat then in those days?
No, it was just the country that was looking after Syria next door to us. We used to have liaison visits to them.
With the French?
With the French, yes. I went to, a couple of times, I went down to Damascus, you know, on liaison visits, and they used to come to our place, Amman, Transjordan. And, oh yes, we were on good terms with the French then.
When you went to Damascus, who did you go with?
With the Air Force. Used to fly these aeroplanes of ours. They would have a 9A's, 9X we called the aircraft there. 9X, we used to fly with them, and a flight, you say, three or four aircraft would go, and we mixed with the French Air Force. The French Air Force was there. We mixed with them while we were there. We stopped probably a couple of days, and when they came back to us, they'd do the same sort of thing. Because the French could, most of the French seemed to understand a fair amount of English, and some of us knew a little bit of French, so we got on very well. We were very good, very good neighbours. Yes.
But how many of you went to Damascus?
At a time, you mean?
Well, on the occasion when you went.
Well, there would be four aeroplanes, that would be eight of us or so. There was only two in an aeroplane. They were supposed to be bombers, you see. No, De Havilland 9A was a bomber, you see, two-seater bomber. But when we used to chase the tribes at times, when we bombed them at all, we used to throw the bombs over the side to get at them, you know. We had racks underneath the wings to drop the bombs from, but invariably we used to throw the bombs over the side at them.
How accurate could you be?
Well, we'd be very low, so we were probably 40% accurate, I should think. 35-40% accurate.
This was in Transjordan, wasn't it, where you were doing the bombing?
Yes, yes, we chased the tribes there quite a bit.
Why were you bombing the tribes?
Mainly because they'd stolen somebody else's cattle. That was the main thing. Or they were in areas where they shouldn't be and they wouldn't move when they were told to, so we just bombed them out. I remember only one occasion where we completely wrote off a village. Because they wouldn't leave, people wouldn't leave this village, so they gave them the warning, and we wrote the village off by bombing it. Really.
How did you give them the warning?
Oh, I don't know, through our SSO, a Secret Service officer, you know. Once again, when he was there, old Lawrence of Arabia had the same sort of job, you see. And I can't remember the chappy's name was there, a well-known name. He used to go out with a native wireless operator who used to then used to report back to us at Amman, you see, used to report back to us. I always remember that wireless operator, native wireless operator I was on I was doing some operating one day, and he was sitting beside me listening, you see, just to make his training okay. And the message came through, so he said, "How fast was that?" So I said, 25 words a minute, you see, it's in Morse. He said, "Mr. Lucas," he said, "you must be clever," he said, "to be able to read it 25 words a minute." And I felt very mucked about this. And it suddenly struck me, I said, "How many languages can you speak?" So he says, "Oh, only seven." He thought I was clever.